Hello, this is Randy Thompson from the North Carolina Reading Service. Welcome to Music Review. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind or print impaired. For the next half hour, I shall be reading articles about music from such sources as the New York Times, the News and Observer, the Week Magazine, Rolling Stone, and Entertainment Weekly. Music Review is underwritten by Bill McClure, tuning pianos in the Raleigh area since 1968. For more information or to schedule a piano tuning appointment, please call 919-779-1755. This program is designed to provide the latest coverage of classical, folk, jazz, blues, rock, country, and pop music news. But first, these musical trivia questions. Today's trivia questions come to us from the website onthisday.com. Question number one. Who was it that on this very day, back in 1978, performed for U.S. President Jimmy Carter at a White House picnic? Was that A, the Beach Boys, B, Muddy Waters, C, the Modern Jazz Quartet, D, the Nitty Gritty Dirt Band, or E, all of the above? So who performed at Jimmy Carter's White House picnic back in 1978? And question number two. Who was it that on this very day was fired from the Grand Ole Opry and told not to return until they sobered up? Was that A, Hank Williams, B, Patsy Cline, C, Johnny Cash, D, or Tammy Wynette, or E, all of the above? So, who on this very day did the Grand Ole Opry order to sober up? The answers to these two important trivia questions will be given, as usual, at the end of today's program. Our transitions come to us from that same website, onthisday.com, and today, quote-unquote, is the weekend of August the 9th. Well, it was on this very day, back in 1969, that the non-album single Hot Fun in the Summertime was released by Sly and the Family Stone, 1969 today. And it was 29 years ago today, 1995, that Jimmy Buffett led a birthday celebration for U.S. President Clinton's birthday at the White House. And that was 1995 today.
So this is me swallowing my pride, standing in front of you, saying I'm sorry for that night. And I go back to December all the time. It turns out freedom ain't nothing but missing you, wishing I'd realized what I had in you in mind. I go back to December, turn around and make it all.
Taylor Swift introduces our country music news. It's titled, Taylor Swift and Bach Can Thank Ancient Temples for Modern Music. The basic notes, rests, and harmonies of Western music arose as humans heard how sounds traveled through the first large temples built more than 2,000 years ago. This is written by Lynn Whidden, Scientific American, 26th of July, 2024. Where did Western music come from? Most historical accounts credit composers with the first formations of simple tunes, which eventually led to quote-unquote early music and later classical music, and the many popular forms that have since sprung up. But acoustic ecologists and musicologists have been talking lately about a different foundation, the earliest temples and cathedrals, which literally shaped musical notes and rests that led to song and symphony. Buildings determined how religious leaders chanted and how musicians composed using the first harmonies. The shape and dimensions of early Israeli temples, notably Solomon's Temple, said to have been built in the decade of 950 BCE, were designed to help words spoken at the altar reach people in attendance. The most effective interior design had a certain ratio of length to width to height and took into account the building materials and furnishings. Both the dimensions and materials affected the sound that leaders were able to deliver. Aware of this interplay, early music composers chose pitches, silence, rests, rhythms, and simple harmonies that sounded well throughout the physical building. When ornamentation was added inside, limiting reverberation, the basic dynamics of classical music were set, even as it spread among different societies and religions. Within the nave, as the main interior part of the church came to be called, the early creators of classical music in the 1200s and in the 1400s were able to organize and explore sound. They eventually created polyphony, the layering of simultaneous voices, the harmonies much loved to this day. In this view, the quote-unquote house provided the acoustics for early music creations, and by the late 15th century, the basics of Western music were in place. Even today, many concert halls mimic the plan and dimensions of cathedrals. While scholars have lauded the visual qualities of the basilica style, few have explored the auditory. One landmark study, Sound and Space in Renaissance Venice, Architecture, Music, Acoustics, by architectural historians Deborah Howard and Laura Moretti, examines this. Lifelong ethnomusicologists like myself have long recognized the importance of context for music, but failed to recognize its importance in the development of Western classical music. Studying the space in which music was created adds a new dimension to our understanding of music, the importance of early architecture. Most of us have lost sight of how deeply rooted we are in our physical environments. In medieval times, music experimentation abounded, but it was within the quote-unquote house where an intimation of the possibilities of organized, layered, and unvarying human sound, that is, Western classical music, was to come. Western churches soared to new heights, as did their music. Musicologist Richard Terry is said to have remarked that a mass by Robert Fairfax, a Renaissance composer and organist, was composed with three parts in voices and a fourth part provided by the church building. By the end of the 15th century, the die was cast. Western classical music was on its determined path. By the late Renaissance, the elements of Western music were established, and it sounded best in decorated rectangular cathedrals and churches, aristocratic chapels, and soon to follow, dedicated concert halls. Ancient people saw a need to control their sound space, so they designed the temple. Its plan lives on in cathedrals and concert halls, and almost all the significant contributors to Western music composed within a cathedral space. Although I have provided strong indirect evidence, researchers today could use digital data to recreate interior soundscapes to provide acoustical proof that connects early temple and cathedral spaces with classical music and the explosion of music compositions that has followed. All of us are deeply rooted in our sound environment, and the spaces of the past can inspire us to give further thought to sound in our life. Bucks, Sheep May Safely Graze, introduces our classical and local music news. It's titled A Rootin' Tootin' Symphony. This is written by Billy Warden, published in Our State Magazine, August 2024 issue. A novel program begun in the 1940s sent classical musicians into rural towns and counties across North Carolina. Its goal? To provide music education for all children. The intent had been to kindle a flame of music appreciation, but now it seemed as if attendees at the North Carolina Symphony's concert might sustain actual burns. The performers had rumbled into Franklin in mountainous Macon County by bus one February in the post-war 40s. As was customary for the orchestra's far-flung showcases, the entire region seemed to turn out. Some kids even arrived aboard cattle trucks. But rather than file into a school auditorium, concertgoers huddled against the lashing cold in a sawdust-covered church, warmed only by a blazing potbelly wood stove that pulsed heat through a scalding pipe. "We were all worried for the safety of the children and their parents and friends," recalled the symphony's longtime conductor, Benjamin Swallen, in his memoir, Hard Circus Road. In addition to being worried, the performers were tired and, despite the overworked wood stove, still freezing. They played in their overcoats, but play they did. By this time, the musicians were used to rolling out the world's most exquisite compositions amid North Carolina's humblest environs. The North Carolina Symphony had hit the highway so often that they'd become known as the quote-unquote Suitcase Symphony. Over the decades, this roving carnival of concert musicians expanded the horizons of thousands of school kids while drawing ovations from the nation's art cognoscenti, who'd never seen anything like it. In 1955, a New York Times writer trumpeted the orchestra. "It takes music to communities that had never encountered the living art in this form. It plays for children as well as adults. It has made itself a spirited force in the state." A force unleashed by an often discordant body, the North Carolina General Assembly, when it composed one of its oddest named pieces of legislation in the state's history, the Horn Tootin' Bill. As North Carolina's First Lady hurried to the legislature, she found the March air unseasonably frosty, which was appropriate considering that her mission would wind up sending musicians into the cold for decades to come. The year was 1943, the anxious middle slog of World War II, and Alice Broughton had established a reputation in Raleigh as a woman of taste and determination. On this day, she set her sights on the state's cultural landscape, where, at the time, around 40% of folks lived on farms, often without electricity or indoor plumbing. While the symphony had existed since 1932, its fortunes had risen and fallen like a Wagnerian drama. What it needed, the Swallens argued, was stable, recurring funding. The reception from at least one legislator, however, was chilly. A House member reportedly rose during the symphony funding debate to describe his trek from his rural district and a woman whom he'd seen toiling in a farm field. Quote, unquote, "That poor soul could have a son in World War II," the legislator protested. "What would she say if she heard I voted for this horn-tootin' bill?" Outreach and education, not glitzy galas, were the orchestra's signature melody, and they would remain so. Backed by a powerful lobby of club women, the Greensboro Record wrote, the bill sailed through easily. The symphony at last had the reliable revenue and institutional support that would help attract hefty grants and additional private donors. Now it could toot its horns around the mostly agrarian 48,600-square-mile North Carolina like never before. The orchestra shifted into high gear. Packed into a pair of red and yellow buses, the musicians brought Mozart to the mountains, Bach to the beach. They performed Strauss's Blue Danube Waltz and Copland's Red Pony, alongside arrangements of down-home ditties like Cripple Creek and Johnson's Old Gray Mule. By the 1951 concert season, the symphony was logging 8,500 travel miles and saw the legislature up its annual horn-tootin' subsidy to $15,000. Come 1978, the miles had more than doubled as the state support swelled to nearly $1 million. Awaiting the buses, as always, were the wide eyes and attentive ears of school kids. Black and white photos in Hard Circus Road hint at the mood and magic. In one shot, pairs of bare feet emerge from beneath the rolled-up dungarees of boys standing on dirt and pebbles waiting to get into a performance. In another photo from the State Archives of North Carolina, children in knickers grin like jack-o'-lanterns as they experience their first toot of a tuba and whisper of a harp. The students' enthusiasm could be infectious. In the 1950s, a girl intoxicated by the sonorous sensations dashed up and kissed a symphony staffer. The Beatles' I Am the Walrus introduces our rock and pop music news. It's titled Behind the Tongue-in-Cheek Lyrics That Got This Trippy Beatles Song Banned from the BBC. This is written by E.M. Casalina, August the 5th, 2024, AmericanSongwriter.com. There are very few Beatles songs out there that would make anyone clutch their pearls today. However, the 1960s were a different time. Quite a few of the Beatles songs were banned from radio stations in England and even the United States. One such song, surprisingly, was I Am the Walrus, the song playing in the background now, from 1967 album and film Magical Mystery Tour. This psychedelic fun track was actually outright banned by the BBC. This is probably the silliest song by the Beatles to have been banned by the BBC. It's a great track, don't get us wrong, but its lyrics are quite surreal and comical, and also borderline nonsensical. Why on earth would any network ban this particular song from being played? I Am the Walrus is a bizarre odyssey that links together Edgar Allan Poe, Eggman, the Eiffel Tower in Paris, the Earl of Gloucester, cornflakes, and dead dogs. However, none of those lyrics resulted in I Am the Walrus getting banned. Rather, it was the brief mention of a pornographic priestess and knickers that ruffled a few feathers over at the BBC.
Should have seen them kicking Edgar Allan Poe. I am the Eggman. They are the Eggman.
So, why was the Beatles' I Am the Walrus banned from the BBC? The lyrics in question that got the song booted from the network were as follows. Crab-a-locker fishwife, pornographic priestess, boy, you've been a naughty girl, you let your knickers down. It didn't really matter that the song was intended to be surrealist poetry. The BBC was not happy about the words pornographic or knickers being in that song, and they deemed it to be too sexually explicit to be aired. Again, it was definitely the silliest ban of a Beatles song ever. Even John Lennon said that the song had little meaning and was intentionally tongue-in-cheek. The words didn't mean a lot, said Lennon of I Am the Walrus, getting banned by the BBC. People draw so many conclusions, and it's ridiculous. I've had tongue-in-cheek all along. All of them had tongue-in-cheek. It's worth noting that a lot of people love to pick apart the lyrics of the Beatles songs by that point. One should remember that the Beatles were just a few guys making music. They weren't holding the secrets of the universe in their song lyrics. Plus, they had gotten quite experimental by the time Magical Mystery Tour was written and recorded. It's not that crazy to think that Lennon just wanted to write a silly, goofy song. Just because other people see depths of whatever in it, Lennon continued, what does it really mean? I am the Eggman. It could have been the pudding basin, for all I care. It's not that serious. It's not that serious are wise words from the late Beatles leader. So how did you do on today's trivia questions? Well, the answer to our first question, who was it that on this very day, back in 1978, performed for U.S. President Jimmy Carter at a White House picnic? Was it A, the Beach Boys, B, Muddy Waters, C, the Modern Jazz Quartet, D, the Nitty Gritty Dirt Band, or E, all of the above? Correct answer? Answer B, Muddy Waters. His grandmother, Della Grant, raised him after his mother died shortly after his birth, and she gave him the nickname Muddy at an early age because he loved to play in the muddy water of nearby Deer Creek. Waters was added years later, as he began to play harmonica and perform locally in his early teens. Muddy became known as the father of Chicago blues, a type of blues that includes bass, piano, amplified guitars, and drums as a variant of the basic Delta blues of guitars and harmonica. Waters was known for such hits as I'm Your Hoochie Coochie Man. As noted by the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame, he electrified the blues literally and figuratively. You could call his quote unquote, the guitar that launched a thousand bands. Muddy Waters' playing was revelatory, his singing unrivaled. The Rolling Stones took their band name from a Muddy Waters song. The Beatles were influenced by him. And Eric Clapton, in an interview with National Public Radio, acknowledged that he was most influenced by Muddy Waters. On July 9, 1978, Muds performed for U.S. President Jimmy Carter at a White House picnic. And the answer to our second question, who was it that on this very day was fired from the Grand Ole Opry and told not to return until they sobered up? Was that A, Hank Williams, B, Patsy Cline, C, Johnny Cash, D, Tammy Wynette, or E, all of the above? Well, that was back in 1952 on this very day, and that was answer A, Hank Williams. As noted in YouDiscoverMusic.com, Hank Williams had been on thin ice with the organizers of Nashville's already fabled concert and broadcast institution, the Grand Ole Opry, when he pushed his luck too far on August the 9th, 1952. Williams was still a major recording star, but his wayward personal life and unreliable behavior were now leading to serious career recriminations. With his alcohol abuse sometimes getting the better of him, he had missed many appearances at the Opry before, as well as other concert engagements. In June, his movie contract with MGM was canceled. A few weeks later, He and his wife, Audrey, were divorced for the second time, bringing their turbulent relationship to an end. Hank's no-show for his August 9th engagement was one too many for Opry manager Jim Denny. 2 days later, he fired Williams, bringing a sad end to a run on the show that had begun in such glory only 3 years earlier when he became the first performer in Opry history to receive 6 encores. As noted by Rob Sheffield in this week's issue of RollingStone.com, the biggest band in America in 2024 is Creedence Clearwater Revival. CCR are huger than ever right now without anyone really noticing. So, after a wet week on the East Coast, thanks to Debbie, mixed in with some political divisiveness, perhaps this John Fogerty penned tune, 1970s, Who'll Stop the Rain, is an appropriate closing to today's weekly program.
Long as I remember, the rain been coming down. Clouds of mystery pouring, confusion on the ground. Goodness through the ages, trying to find the sun. And I wonder, who'll stop the rain?
Well, we've run out of time for today's episode of Music Review. Be sure to tune in at the same time next week. This program's also available as a podcast after the broadcast in our website, ncreadingservice.org. As we leave you now, remember these words. Kindness is a language which blind people see and deaf people hear. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind or print impaired. If you have a suggestion for music to feature on this program, please leave a message for me at 919-832-5138. I'm Randy Thompson, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. Music Review, underwritten by Bill McClure. Tuning pianos in the Raleigh area since 1968. For more information or to schedule a piano tuning appointment, please call 919-779-1755. So long, until next time.